From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Those new numbers from the Labor Department are both expected and shocking. 6.6 million Americans filed for unemployment last week, an historic record that smashes the previous week's 3.3 million. And Jeremy, as you know, economists believe this could just be the tip of the iceberg.
Exactly. So let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, 10 million unemployed over the course of 2 weeks. That's about 6% of the American workforce. And that's just the people who have filed a claim.
Right.
Which means it could be, you know, worse than the financial crisis in 2008 and what we saw with unemployment then.
Yes, you make an interesting distinction. These are people who have filed for unemployment insurance for the first time, so they were not previously unemployed. The number is incredible. When you add that to the revised number for the prior week, we're up above 10 million people. Now, keep in mind, these things are on a delay, and this still doesn't capture the time period that was the worst of it. So tomorrow we're going to get the unemployment number, but in fact, these things are on a lag, and we've never been, even in 2008, 2009, we virtually were never in a position where we saw this many layoffs at one time. In fact, the worst job losses in the last recession were January of 2009, when we saw about 700,000 people off the rolls. So these numbers have not been seen since the Depression.
And there are already people saying that the $2 trillion rescue package that Congress passed might not be enough. President Trump now says he may want to spend another $2 trillion, this time on an infrastructure program. Is that likely, Ali? And would that help given the unique challenges of what we can call the coronavirus economy?
Well, it won't help for the immediate moment, right? So for the time that we still have an increasing number of stay-at-home orders, there's nothing anybody can do except what countries like Denmark are doing, where they're paying everybody their full salaries. Mm-hmm. The government is doing that. But at some juncture, when we start to reopen, whether that's on Donald Trump's accelerated schedule or some schedule, it is something that has bipartisan support and has been tried in the past. It hasn't succeeded in the last few years, but there is value in the idea that money costs the government very little right now, and there are going to be a lot of people out of work. An infrastructure project might be the kind of thing that we're looking at.
That does suggest, though, that this is not what economists were saying even a few weeks ago, the kind of dip that would just bounce right back afterwards.
Correct.
If you're talking about an infrastructure program, this could be a really long recession.
Yeah, because there are a lot of companies that were hanging on by a thread. Just like we know that so many Americans don't have the extra money to contend with an emergency, America is a country that's built on small businesses. And a lot of those small businesses, those service enterprises, those restaurants, will not come back immediately. So there will be a lot of people, particularly at the lower end to mid-skilled level of things, that won't recover quickly. So as much as a lot of business will get back to normal once we have conquered this disease, not everything will, and there will be a higher level of what we call structural unemployment. It's not part of a cycle. It's part of an actual change in the way we deal with employment.
You mentioned the monthly jobs report that is going to come out tomorrow. This is what we get every single month. They consider it, yep, always to be one of the most important economic indicators. What are you going to be watching for there?
Well, I'm going to be watching for the fact that the measurement, the unemployment number and the number of jobs lost, is a product of two different surveys that are generally taken about mid-month. And I want to remind people that most of the unemployment activity happened after the middle, mm-hmm, of March. So tomorrow, you might not actually see the increase in the unemployment rate that we're expecting. A number of economists, including the president of the Dallas Federal Reserve, have said that we're going to be looking at a number in the mid to high teens in unemployment. Wow. I don't think anybody remembers those kinds of numbers. We got to about 10% in 2009. So right. I don't think you're going to see it all tomorrow. It'll be the report that comes out the beginning of May, which is for April, that'll show the bigger, right, numbers. But we will see a few percentage point increase tomorrow in the unemployment rate.
Ali Velshi, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, let's check in on another city confronting COVID-19, Chicago, where cases are rising, supplies are scarce. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker extended the state's stay-at-home order through the end of April. Claudia Morell from member station WBEZ is here. And Claudia, chilling numbers. Illinois reported almost 1,000 new cases and 42 new deaths just yesterday, most of them in Chicago. Mayor Lori Lightfoot says she expects a peak in the next 2 weeks. So how is the city preparing?
Yeah, as you can imagine, the situation here is escalating. And I remember the first case was, back in March 6th when we had our first, tested positive case of COVID-19 here in Chicago. And so the city has been very proactive. We did a shelter in place right around St. Patrick's Day. And then I believe like right after that weekend, they closed the bars. And you know how in some cities like New York and San Francisco and L.A., they have ships that are docked off the coast. Well, here we are turning one of the convention centers, McCormick Place, which is south of the Loop, mm-hmm. into a temporary hospital that is going to hold about 3,000 beds.
And you have hotels housing first responders. Now, we know that Governor Pritzker says the state is competing for federal supplies, not getting enough. We remember when President Trump said in one of his briefings that he told Mike Pence not to call certain governors because the president felt they weren't appreciative. Is this a feud between Pritzker and Trump, and how's it affecting the state?
So I think like most governors, there's been a sort of frustration here by the governor, Governor Pritzker, with Trump. I think he said that the president was guilty of leadership malpractice and that, you know, that the federal government isn't, you know, someone that we can really rely on right now. And so the state is trying hard to use the resources it has and partner with companies here locally to help, you know, deal with the crisis. So like one example is Abbott Labs, which is based here in Illinois, and how they are going to start doing more rapid testing for the virus.
And we just want to mention, we know that BEZ reported that some residents had no running water because the utilities, the city, turned their water off for lack of payment. But Mayor Lightfoot has put a moratorium on shutoffs. It's just that those who had their water turned off, it's still off, so they can't wash their hands. We'll follow that. BEZ political reporter Claudia Morell, thank you.
Thank you.
COVID-19 is felling nurses, young adults. It took Tommy DePaula, whose Strega Nona children's books were based on his own grandmother's, and pianist Ellis Marsalis, the patriarch of a New Orleans jazz dynasty, who died yesterday at 85. He was a composer, father to six, including musicians Brandon, Winton, Delfeo, and Jason, teacher to Harry Connick and so many others. Jazz historian Bruce Rayburn was a good friend. He's curator emeritus of Hogan Jazz Archive. And Bruce, you know, so sorry for your loss, so sorry for ours. Can you remind us of the legacy of Ellis Marsalis long before he produced the dynasty he did?
Ellis was a remarkable giver on so many levels. It's hard to choose. He was probably, along with David Baker, the greatest jazz educator on the planet. Mm-hmm. He was a gifted and elegant pianist. He worked with Ornette Coleman in the 1950s and then developed a solo style. He had a regular Friday night at Snug Harbor, New Orleans. It was always well attended. And of course, you know, as the patriarch of the Marsalis family, all of his jazz sons have their own voices, and he and his wife Dolores are responsible for that, I think. They created the right environment for those musicians to flourish.
How did he change jazz in his presence in New Orleans and outside of it?
Well, the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts is an arts magnet school in New Orleans, and it's become internationally recognized for the people that have come through it. Harry Connick Jr., Terrence Blanchard, so many others that are well-known, and street musicians like Doreen Ketchins, the clarinetist. They all revere Ellis because he was a very strict teacher, very demanding, and he brought them up. So I think NOCA is one of his greatest accomplishments. And then he built the jazz program at the University of New Orleans.
Yeah. And the NOCA, the first full-time public arts high school in New Orleans, he taught his own sons there. So, you know, when he was strict with them, too. Do you have a memory, though, as a friend, you know, something that we may not, you know of?
I served on the Jazz Commission with Ellis that set up the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park. Senator J. Bennett Johnson initiated that in the late 80s, early 90s. And Ellis and Lindy Boggs were the co-chairs of the commission that that studied the feasibility of that study. And it was remarkable to see how gracious he could be, but also how demanding he could be with the various people who wanted things in that park. And he and Lindy were a tag team that were just amazing to watch. So that's one of my favorite memories.
Yeah. Very elegant, but very firm in what he wanted it to be like. Jazz historian Bruce Rayburn remembering his friend Ellis Marsalis, the patriarch of the New Orleans jazz dynasty, and as we hear so much more, who died at 85 yesterday. His son Brandon said it was from complications from the coronavirus. Boy, Bruce, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Robin. We're trying to recover from the loss.
Yeah. Ellis Marsalis and his quintet performing in 2018 at the George and Joyce Wien Jazz and Heritage Center, streamed by WWOZ in New Orleans. We need this here and now.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
Germany has nearly as many coronavirus cases as China, but Germany's death toll is much lower. Why is that? Let's go to the BBC's Damian McGuinness. He is in Berlin. Damian, what is the explanation? Is it all about testing?
Yeah, it is essentially more testing, Jeremy. So one former medical official here said there's no German miracle. He said, just German efficiency with an immense frequency of tests at the start. So if you look at the numbers right now, the latest Johns Hopkins University figures show that Germany has around about 78,000 cases, but less than 1,000 deaths, so around about 944 deaths. Italy, if you compare there, and Spain, around 110,000 confirmed cases, which is not that much more than Germany, really. But mm-hmm. here in Italy, you're talking 13,000 deaths, and in Spain, 10,000 deaths. So 10 times more deaths than in Germany. But what it means, really, is that because in Germany the number of tests is so much higher, you're talking around about 500,000 a week, which is an incredibly high number. You know, in Britain, it's about a tenth of that. What that means is that other European countries are not showing the correct infection rate. So in Germany, more medical professionals, more people with no or few symptoms are being tested. So what that means is the real figure in countries elsewhere that do less testing is actually much higher. Also in Germany, more young people at the beginning became sick or were infected mm-hmm. with coronavirus. Now, of course, young people, as we know, are less likely to die. So that brought the rate down. But all of that, Jeremy, is now changing. So older people are now getting coronavirus. Experts say Germany shouldn't be complacent. They're saying this is the calm before the storm, because as it spreads, the death toll will rise. And so officials say you can't really rule out scenes in Germany like the ones we're seeing in Italy right now.
And what about the restrictions? The chancellor there, Angela Merkel, says that Germany's restrictions will remain in place until April 19th. What is life like there? Are people going outside at all, or are they wearing masks?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's very quiet on the streets, much quieter than usual. You do see the occasional person with masks, which is very interesting here in Germany, because that was unheard of before. At the moment, officials are saying they're not going to make it compulsory to wear masks, but that could change if masks become more available and if the situation gets worse.
I want to ask you one more thing. Obviously, coronavirus is having an effect on economies all over the world, but Germany is the richest country in the European Union. Is it being asked at this point, and is it giving other EU countries help for their economies, or is it expected to do that?
Yeah, that is an incredibly live debate right now. It's a big controversy. Even in one newspaper today, or in a number of newspapers right now, that's the front page story. to what extent should Germany be helping southern European countries, particularly Italy and Spain, that are suffering so much? There's growing pressure from the population and from the press, interestingly enough, saying that the government should help. Everyone shares a currency within the Eurozone. What we had a decade ago with the financial crisis was a very controversial debate about northern European countries being asked to share debt. That did not happen because it was seen as a liability and it would make the economies less competitive. We've got a similar debate now, but what the calls are right now for northern European countries such as the Netherlands and Germany to do a short-term shared liability. So it's quite a complicated matter, but I think the upshot is that pressure is growing on countries like Germany to help southern European countries. Already we're seeing intensive care patients from Italy and France being flown into German hospitals which have spare capacity. So far, that's only symbolic, though. The will is there among the population, but there is also big debate about how much that would weaken the entire Eurozone currency. So it's an incredibly controversial debate, which we're at the beginning of right now. We're certainly not going to see that debate die down anytime soon.
That is the BBC's Damian McGuinness speaking with us from Berlin. Damian, thank you.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Jeremy.
Well, in this country, President Trump says the nationwide supply of personal protective equipment, or PPE, is nearly gone. It is an alarming message for the healthcare workers who are facing equipment shortages at hospitals across the country as more coronavirus-infected patients are admitted. In Louisville, Kentucky, dozens of employees in the Norton healthcare system have tested positive. One of them is Shelley Urquhart. She's a pulmonary and critical care nurse practitioner at the Norton Audubon Hospital. She says she contracted the virus at the hospital even while wearing all of the recommended PPE. She joins us now. Shelley, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And how are you feeling now?
Much better, but I had a pretty difficult 2 weeks. But I'm finally on the mend and glad to be able to join you today.
Well, and tell us how it started. How did you realize that you might have COVID-19?
Well, I took care of a critically ill patient Friday afternoon, and Monday I developed a fever and a cough, and so I was furloughed on the following morning and had a COVID swab collected, and 9 days later I found out it was positive.
9 days later, it took that long to get the test result?
Yes.
Wow. So how do you think you got it if you were wearing all the PPE that's necessary or that's supposed to keep you from getting COVID-19?
You know, the unfortunate answer there is it's probably not enough protection. Even with, you know, an N95 mask, eye protection, gown and gloves, I unfortunately still contracted this, as did several other providers who took care of the same patients. So it's a little bit concerning. These N95 masks are fitted to our face. We have to go through a, you know, fitting test every single year to make sure that we're still using the right size mask. And so it really, in theory, should give you good protection. But for some reason, you know, I still got this.
So I understand that you also experienced the symptoms that a lot of people are reporting with COVID-19, which is a loss of taste and smell.
Yes.
And how long after your initial symptoms did that start happening?
I got sick on, it was a Monday night, and by that following Saturday, and it was an abrupt change because I had not had much of an appetite, but I was at least able to eat something. And then I woke up on a Saturday morning and could not smell or taste anything. And it has not even returned fully yet.
Really? So that's still lingering. And where are we right now? How long ago was the initial symptom experience?
I am just now at the 2 week mark.
So have you been tested again?
No, we are doing a process at my hospital where you're off for 2 weeks from the time that you were tested. And then once you are fever free and symptom free for 72 hours, then you can report back to work.
So are you pretty confident at this point that you are not going to be spreading this to anybody else?
Yes.
Since you are a healthcare worker right on the front lines of this crisis, and now you have experienced it yourself by actually getting COVID-19, what do you think about how the whole country is responding to this? Are we doing enough? And I say we, not just governments, but everybody, are we doing enough?
I think some areas of the country have really implemented aggressive measures from the beginning. You know, I'm in Kentucky, and our governor, right from the beginning, as soon as we had our first case, implemented very, very strict stay-at-home measures. So state and local governments, I think, have been really instrumental in helping to have consistent messaging. And the federal government, we haven't seen very consistent messaging from them. And so I think there's a lot of room for improvement from that standpoint.
Are you worried that where you are in Louisville, Kentucky, that you're going to have the same issues later that places like New York are experiencing now?
I hope not. We've done a good job at staying at home and, you know, implementing these measures early, but that may not be enough. You're still seeing community spread, and you're seeing a lot of healthcare workers that have become infected. Then they take it home to their families. And so you're still going to see some spread, unfortunately, just because it's easy to catch.
I want to ask you one more thing, Shelley, which is that you live in Louisville with your 10-year-old son and your aunt who has COPD and asthma. What was it like when you were quarantined with them around?
Well, it was difficult. You know, of course, there's the worry for my aunt who, you know, she's also immunocompromised. So she takes medicines for her rheumatoid arthritis. In addition, she has lung disease. And so it's been really stressful just knowing that I, you know, went to work, did everything I was supposed to do, and still brought this home to my household. You know, I had to tell my 10-year-old through the door that my COVID swab was positive, and he cried. And he made me promise him that I wouldn't die. And having to try to comfort a child, you know, from behind closed doors is just immensely difficult. More difficult than being sick is just not being able to be there when your child needs you.
Well, we are glad that you are feeling better and that you are there for your 10-year-old son and for your aunt. And we hope that you all stay healthy and safe. That is Shelley Urquhart, who's a pulmonary and critical care nurse practitioner in Louisville, Kentucky, recovering from COVID-19. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Media consumption during the coronavirus outbreak has skyrocketed. So many at home, such a compelling story. But advertising revenue is falling fast. One ad buying firm estimates it will be almost 10% lower than projected for 2020. And what's there is evolving. Here now, media analyst John Carroll has been watching. John, you know, it's sort of like we can see the pandemic in stages through the advertising waves. What are you seeing?
Right. First, we had the whoops phase where brands realized that their ads were wildly inappropriate for a public health crisis. So Geico pulled an ad with people high-fiving. KFC ceased to be finger-licking good. And beer companies pulled ads that showed crowded bar scenes.
Right, because we saw them and it was wince-inducing. But then came a second wave, ads that directly addressed the outbreak. Car companies are offering home delivery of cars. Russell Stover ads. There's a, you know, one that you can send a box of candy and it will be a virtual hug. I don't think I've ever seen a Russell Stover candy ad on TV before. And then there's this Budweiser TV spot. It featured healthcare professionals, relief workers, lab technicians, soldiers, everyday people.
This Bud's for the Blues, the Reds, and the Warriors. This Bud's for the Giants, the Jazz, and the Magic. This Bud's for the home team.
Right note, John?
Yeah, I think Budweiser has a history of trying to help out during natural disasters. In this case, they took $5 million from their ad budget for sporting events, gave it to the Red Cross to conduct blood drives all across the country.
Yeah, they're hitting the right note. Walmart's running a similar ad. We hear the Walmart president and CEO, Doug McMillon, praising his employees. Let's listen.
I've always seen your spark, your dedication, and humanity. But today, as you're being challenged more than ever, I see heroes.
It is so heartwarming, and low-wage workers are on the front lines. But as I was watching, John, it also made me think, well, I hope you're paying them to do this.
You know, exactly. Yeah. This is kind of a high-wire act because you're trying to burnish your brand while bad news is swirling all about you. You know, most people think that you should not be exploiting this situation, but only 8% in one survey thought you should actually pull ads.
Right, so just try to get it right. Well, many companies, though, aren't spending any money on ads. They don't want to be associated with the pandemic, right?
Right, and this is the third wave, which is knee-buckling decreases in ad spending. So you have estimates that newspaper ad revenue will be down 50% perhaps, TV down around 40%. Facebook usage is way up, but online advertising is way down. Mm-hmm. And BuzzFeed reported that over 3,000 advertisers have basically blocked the word coronavirus from their ads. So their ads will not appear next to any pandemic coverage. And that's really hurting a lot of news organizations.
Well, there's been layoffs, furloughs, cuts to benefits and salaries at some organizations. Big news organizations are probably going to do okay, but in the few seconds we have, this is the time, I think, to buy your local paper?
Absolutely. Only 16% of people pay for news in this country, and this is proving that a lot more should.
Yeah. This is the time to support the people who are the ones that will cover your backyard. Here now, media analyst John Carroll. John, thanks as always, and stay well.
Thank you. You too.
The price of oil jumped more than 20% this morning after President Trump said he's confident Saudi Arabia and Russia will end a price war that has sent the industry into a tailspin. That would be good news for Midland, Texas, in the heart of the Permian Basin. The city of 173,000 was already reeling from oil prices that cratered to around $20 a barrel. And now the coronavirus is making the crisis worse. Joining us now is Midland Mayor Patrick Payton. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks for letting me on.
Well, and this is your first term. What has it been like dealing with this 1-2 punch? First, the collapse in oil prices to $20 a barrel. And now, of course, the situation everybody's dealing with, the coronavirus.
Yeah, well, I think you said it exactly right. A 1-2 punch is exactly what we're dealing with. I originally grew up in Oklahoma surrounded by tornadoes, and I kind of feel like we're waking up every day with a tornado that's not just ravaged one portion of our city. But really, you've woken up to a tornado that's torn up the entire city every single day, and it's happening every single morning. So it's been quite intense for a first-term mayor within 3 months of being sworn in.
Well, and give us a sense of what you mean when you say it's ravaged the city. How is this playing out in Midland?
Well, it's playing out, first of all, with a lot of people already beginning to get layoffs. And even to back up a little bit, come March 4th, the morning of March 4th, after we all woke up from, I believe it was Sunday the 3rd, when the futures market was already somewhat in the tank and what was going on with Saudi Arabia and Russia, you literally saw the oil and gas industry just shut down and things just stopped. Drilling stopped, completions stopped, and we knew it was going to be pretty serious. We'd been through ups and downs before here in West Texas, but very rarely do you just see companies are literally shutting down, already talking about layoffs, and then within 5 days from that, on that Friday, things really start heating up related to the coronavirus. And so you've got sort of mass fear related to people's health. And then on top of that, you've got the proverbial pink slip showing up by the hundreds and even the thousands now. And so when you say ravaged, it's one of those things where if you lose your job, you can maybe get outside and hang out with your friends or go to the bar or go have a drink at a restaurant. But now people are losing their jobs. They can't get out. They're afraid to get out. Nobody can travel. And so just about every outlet you might have had is shut down to you. And everything, every hope you had for the future is pretty much on hold now.
Do you think that President Trump has done enough, given his relationship, not just with the Russian president, but also with the royal family in Saudi Arabia? Do you think he's done enough to try to get them to cut production and get oil prices to go back up?
Well, I think if you talk to most of us out here in the Permian Basin, it's not just President Trump we're concerned about. It's the entire Congress as well, taking action, considering that Saudi Arabia is someone we have defended and has been an ally of ours, especially in battles against Iran. And so as you talk to other people around here as well, the more important issue for our nation and for our city is not just oil and gas. It's the health and welfare of our workers and our economy, because, you know, that's been the interesting conversation among producers and oil and gas exploration companies out here. Is they're not just worried about their own industry, but now this has turned into something even more serious for all of us. So secondarily, do we want the President and Congress to do more related to Saudi Arabia? Yes. First and foremost, though, we have to realize this coronavirus issue has got to come first.
So you have said before that you are worried that the depression that would come from unemployment being so high could kill as many people as the coronavirus itself. Do you still think that?
When you talk about our region, when you look at the numbers that we have a history here in Midland, Texas, where people can go through quite a whipsaw related to the economic conditions here. And I was very concerned, as I stated in one of our city council meetings, I was very, very concerned that we had a run on ammunition here in this hunting region of the country. And so I realize when people are under a lot of stress, when people have all areas of their life being stressed and put under pressure, I'm absolutely concerned about mental health, and I'm concerned about what the outcomes of that can be. I'm concerned that not only in Midland, but as I'm looking around the country, even rehab groups and Alcoholics Anonymous groups and counseling groups are having a difficult time being able to meet because of restrictions.
Right.
So there are a lot of unforeseen issues I think we're all going to face in this regard. So I do stand by the statement that I think we could see as much maybe suicide or death in our region, when you look at the numbers of what we're looking at with just the coronavirus not being like they are in a place tragically like New York or San Francisco or other places, that people have nowhere to go, they have no hope, and they have no place to find that hope. And so they're turning to tragic ends.
So what do you think the government should do?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think what we're beginning to, we all say that's a really good question. We don't have an answer, right? I think the first thing, we're beginning to see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel, that in that tunnel being the radical partisanship that we've all watched, whether we're Republican or whether we're Democrat, and make sure we're paying attention to the greater needs of the community. I know here our nonprofits and our churches are doing all the things that they can do. We've had a tremendous outpouring of partnership across every different denomination and every social sector. And so I'm hoping, and I don't think I'm speaking just as way out here West Texas, I think a lot of us are ready for our government to quit seeing who can have the best soundbite or who can have the best Twitter feed, and who can start paying attention to what the bigger issues are and how we solve those issues like we have with other national tragedies.
Given what we've seen in the oil markets in recent days, do you think that looking forward, that oil and the oil industry should play the same role in the future of Midland as it has in the past? Or do you think you're setting yourself up for more boom-bust cycles, if so?
Well, I think for quite a long time we've been asking ourselves that question. The reality is, I'm not sure that anybody outside of Midland really quite understands the central nature of oil and gas does here, just like somebody really wouldn't know what tourism industry is like unless they live in Orlando or Las Vegas. And because that's just the nature of it out here. It's not just something you turn off. It's one of the largest oil fields in the world, and we're still going to need this source of energy and this source of byproducts, even as we push towards what might be an alternative energy revolution in the future. You just can't get there until you get there through your oil and gas and oil and gas byproducts.
Mayor Payton, one of the things that makes this situation so scary is just the uncertainty. People not sure what things are going to look like on the other side and how much of our old lives we'll be able to get back after this collective experience of dealing with the coronavirus. What do you think things will be like after this is over? Do you think we're going to go back to business the way it was before?
Boy, that's probably a question you're asking every single guest, and I wouldn't be surprised if every single guest, maybe saying the same things. I don't see any way we get back to what we used to be. It's going to be a new normal around here. It's going to be another national reset. It's going to be an international reset again. I was talking to an oil and gas executive this morning, and I think we all just have come to this place where we said, normal is just going to be different. And any of us think we're going to get back to a different way of doing things, We're just not. And I would never, ever, ever make a comparison to what happened at 9/11. But a new normal was introduced after 9/11. It changed the world as well. Right. And now we're in a worldwide issue. And I think we would be ridiculously naive to think things are going to go back to the world we knew back in February.
No, I think you're right to be careful about making comparisons to 9/11. But the fact is, I think this is going to be one of those moments when you talk about pre-COVID and post-COVID 20 years from now.
You and I both remember the statement. Well, where were you on 9/11? Where I was in right. Oklahoma when the Murrah Federal Building blew up. Where were you? I remember everything about it. We're to this place now where it's, what was your life like pre-COVID? Because there's no day. It just, our times have changed, and literally the way we even describe it is more long-term wartime than it is an event that happened. And those things, events change nations, and this is an event that's changing the globe. And so it's very hard to just wrap your mind around how many of us have been with our friends and said, I don't even know what to make of this. And we're all in that particular place.
That is Mayor Patrick Peyton of Midland, Texas, who, by the way, you wouldn't be surprised to find out is a former pastor as you listen to him talk. Mayor Peyton, thank you so much for joining us and best of luck.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
There will be no strawberries and cream at Wimbledon this summer. The All England Club has canceled the tennis tournament, the first time that's happened since World War II, and it's just the latest major sporting event to join the list of those derailed by COVID-19. Mike Pesk is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, you know, Wimbledon canceled, the French Open pushed back till after the U.S. Open. It was supposed to start in late August. You know, I'm a tennis fan, and I'm finding myself thinking, okay, it just feels like we're in a time where, all right, no sports.
Yeah, yeah. And the plans to push them back, I mean, those are just that. Those are plans. Right now, the Billie Jean King Tennis Center, where the U.S. Open is held, is a staging area. It's a hospital. It's a mobile hospital. And the reason that Wimbledon canceled and didn't postpone, as opposed to those other ones, is because Wimbledon is, of course, an all-grass tournament. You can only really play in summer and spring. And they decided, as you say, the first time since World War II, the only other time was World War I. So that puts it in perspective what we're up against if it's this and two world wars to cancel Wimbledon.
Yeah, we're up there with world wars. And you know, I think a lot of people are just grasping this because, not to put to put too fine a point on it, there was the sense of, you know, filling the pews by Easter. Now there's a sense of we're probably not going to be doing much till the fall. And certainly people aren't going to be flocking to stadiums. So talk about leagues that suspended their seasons, the NBA, the NHL.
People are gonna,
go ahead.
I do think people are going to be very reluctant to flock to stadiums. And this isn't the fault of the commissioners of the leagues when they were perhaps optimistically saying, oh, we'll suspend until April, or in baseball's case, until May. But those do seem unrealistic. They seem especially unrealistic on sports that really do rely on the live gate. So not football, which is a television sport mostly, but basketball, definitely the NHL, absolutely dependent on people coming to those stadia. And without a test that can be administered quickly, I mean, you're going to have to try to get 20,000 people into the gate with this Abbott test that we talk about takes 5 to 13 minutes. It just seems unworkable. Both the NHL and the NBA have toyed with plans pushing the season back into the summer and having a truncated season. But again, those are just plans, and they do not know what's going
to
happen.
You know, we're going to be talking to futurists next week, Mike, but I don't know if you've been looking that far down the road. Do you think we're looking at big changes in how we gather and how we watch or play sports?
Yeah, I think we have to, because the coming together, even though we talk about how important sports are as televised properties, the coming together is very important for them economically, but it also gives the players and gives the fans real meaning. So sports played or conducted professional sports apart from thousands of people thronging together just are in sports. And we heard, you know, LeBron James and others say, I don't want to play if it's not in front of fans. So that will have to be a recalculation. And the big thing is when all these epidemiologists talk about waves, some of the scheduling of these sports would be right about where, if all goes well, there could be a second wave.
Right.
And you would hate for your sporting event to take on the sheen of that Philadelphia parade during Spanish influenza, where everyone points to, you know, a Rangers Blues game as this vector of contagion.
Yeah.
So they really, really have to rethink this, as society does.
Well, meanwhile, what they're doing, and I'm talking about the TV networks now, is they're airing things that, I mean, I looked up at one point and there was this women's hockey game, and I apologize, I don't even know what it was, but it was from a long time ago. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I never saw that, you know, ice hockey. And, you know, they're airing things. Well, tell us what they're doing.
Well, they're doing some cherry spitting. They're doing some ESPN has that network they call the Ocho, which is based on a joke in the movie Dodgeball, and they're airing some of that. I was surprised to learn, though, the last full week of full sports, ESPN was averaging just over a million viewers. And with a week of absolutely not only no live sports, but nothing to cover, they're averaging 544,000 viewers. It's not that bad. They had been predicting an 80% drop-off. It looks like a 50% drop-off. I think the NFL, because there was a lot of off-season news, the NFL has been the one lifeline, if you will, for ESPN programming. And the NFL draft will be, I mean, it always puzzled me why it was such a big sporting event when it really is just an exercise in human resources. But I understand it now. This will become the closest thing to an actual sporting event the country has seen for months when they stage the NFL draft.
Right. Well, and by the way, ESPN, for instance, has to get some of the league's permission to re-air stuff. And so there was Tom Brady's greatest games on one weekend. And I just want to point out what people are at home are doing, Mike. This is some of the most fun. Like, there's a family with a lot of adult brothers who put together a video of each of them in different parts of the country threw a baseball to one frame, you know, of a picture, and then the others seemed to catch it, and they made it look like they were all playing baseball together. So people
to point out that that is more action than a regular baseball game, so that's part of its appeal.
Mike Pesca here, now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.